Hello, everybody. I hope you're writing your own gospel and living your own myth. And I hope you are enjoying spring like I am here in Northern Illinois. Indeed, Priapus and Persephone are holding court, and I'm enjoying it. Enjoying the weather, the changing weather, and just to wear a wife beater for, well, to be comfortable for a while. But I'm here for other reasons, and that's to remind you of Astrognosis 3. Why am I reminding you now? Because early bird tickets will stop being on sale at the end of the month, and I want you to take advantage of it. You'll save $20 if you order before May, and regardless, it's a good time to remind you of Astrognosis 3. The last two have been very successful, and this one will be even bigger and better, as they say. The theme of this year is Sophia and Simulated Realities. So you're going to get an amazing education, presentations, and panels on the Divine Feminine in Gnosticism. Why Simulated Realities? Well, as many of you know, once Sophia fell from the Pleroma, she created a lot of false realities, and we're in one of those right now. So you'll get that gnosis to be able to break through your false reality, or at the very least, find out who you are or get closer to who you are. The guests this year are going to be amazing. We've got coming back Mitch Horowitz, Richard Smoley, Steven Snyder, and James True. And I'm finalizing some of our new guests, and these already include Ola Wolny, Rhyme, David Block, and some other ones that are going to make the entire Sophia and Simulated Realities a complete mind bomb. And again, self-discovery for you. One of our guests who's coming back, who's done the last 2 years, is my friend Chris Knowles. And if you're watching this, you're going to get his full presentation from last year. Last year was the theme was Meet the Archons, and his presentation, which is completely mind-expanding and reality-disbanding, is entitled Our Transdimensional Archons. It's intense. You might have to sleep with the lights on or burn some sage after this, because Chris brings the entire John Keel and Charles Fort vibe into things. It's amazing, and I know this year Chris will even blow us even more away. Chris's mind is like Dionysian fine wine. He just gets better with age. So many other researchers and scholars, they find their great idea or revelation, and then they sort of plateau, and they add a little bit here and a little bit there, but Chris's mind just keeps exploring, keeps breaking away at layers of reality to find truer realities. His mind often reminds me of individuals like Tracy Twyman, rest in peace, and Whitney Webb. He just keeps going, and he will keep going at Astrognosis 3, and I think you'll love his entire presentation. Again, as a little promo for this year's Astrognosis. So I hope to see you there. As I keep saying, there is nothing like these physical encounters that we have. They are incredible. We always end up forging new and strong friendships. We create egregores, and in a way we create amazing magic to defeat Themdar Archons. There really is nothing like it. And as I've said before, the real gnosis always happens or the real personal gnosis happens away from the presentations, in the parking lot, in the hallways, at our various social events. That's where you find this pure electricity, this soul-expanding experience. So highly recommended, and that's why I do these things. The Archons, They want to keep us isolated. They don't want us to connect as humans. They want to keep us isolated. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I love technology, using it right now. I love how technology has allowed us to connect. I've made lifelong friends through technology in the online realms. It's great to be able to share this important information for the liberation of the soul and the psyche. And I love to be able to spread these ideas to others who might be interested. These contraband ideas of Gnosticism, and so many of you creators and cool peeps are doing it. So online is great, but ultimately, it's just pixels. I'm right now pixels to you, you're pixels to me. So these physical events really change the game. So I hope to see you again at Astronosis 3, August 9th and 10th at the Theosophical Society. See you in the parking lot or the hallway or at the social or whenever. It's going to be awesome. And links on the show notes, email me, just find out and hope it's going to be great. I will see you there with Sophia and we will break through so many simulated realities. Again, write your own gospel, live your own myth, with or without the wife beater.
First of all, I want to thank the other presenters. It's been illuminating and inspiring to me, and is giving me new keys to apply to my own work. I'm going to try to bring some of what has been discussed into our present time and our present situation and shed light on what I see as our present challenge. Some of you might not be familiar with my work. I guess I'm roughly called a synchromystic, but I consider myself a supernaturalist. Mystic is also fine. I believe in the spirit world, the supernatural, and the divine. I don't come to these beliefs lightly, and I believe we are in a struggle with forces outside our world, or forces from outside our world, who use us in the same way any parasitical organism uses its host. Okay. I'm going to lay my cards out on the table from the jump. I see the archons, or what we call them as such, as being very real, non-conceptual entities. I believe we've been in contact with these entities for a very long time, and they have exerted a decisive influence over our lives and our civilization for a very long time. I believe they are reasserting themselves in our world to an unparalleled degree and are doing so through means that are now understood and documented, and we'll get into those. Some call them archons, some call them watchers, some angels, some demons, some call them jinn. Today, some call them machine elves or DMT jesters. The terms are secondary. What it boils down to is that entities have used various methods to interfere in our world and have bestowed various forms of knowledge, including technology, upon us for their own purposes, not for our benefit. And we are increasingly seeing the toll these entities take for these gifts. To put it simply, we are being colonized. We have been colonized for a very long time. The colonists act exactly as colonists that we know of have acted throughout history. They divide and rule, they bestow certain gifts to certain groups, set those groups up against each other. And in this case, the technologies that we've been bestowed on following the Second World War are now starting to take a terrible toll, particularly on our children. We are seeing rates of suicide, depression, drug abuse, all these things skyrocket. And I would refer you to, this is a completely non-mystic source, but there's a professor from, I believe he's from either NYU or Columbia, named Jonathan Haidt, who's done really outstanding work on what is commonly called the Zoomers and the absolutely catastrophic state that the generation that we're going to rely on in the future to maintain our civilization are in, okay? So, with that said, let me get into the slides. So you might recognize this image, some of you. This is from Star Trek. Well, it's very blurry. It's not your eyesight. It's intentionally blurred. These are called the Talosians, And they are very much archons. They're world creators, they're illusion creators. This is from the very Gnostic Star Trek pilot called The Cage. And in case you're wondering, I don't believe that Gene Roddenberry actually wrote this story. He was just too stupid. Genesis 6, 1 through 2. And it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men and that they were fair and took them as wives, of which they all chose. And this is the key here. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came unto the daughters of men, and they bore children to them, the same became mighty men, which were of old, men of renown. And in the original Hebrew, the term is Nephilim, the fallen ones. This is from Jude in the New Testament. And the angels, which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, he hath reserved in everlasting chains under darkness, unto the judgment of the great day. This is a story that goes throughout history, these angelic beings that interfere with human history, human events. This is the Titans and Tartarus. And actually, the Watchers are actually sent to Tartarus as well in Enoch. And also, we're going to see the Archons themselves. This is from First Enoch. And beyond that abyss, I saw a place which had no firmament of the heaven above and no firmly founded earth beneath it. There was no water upon it and no birds. It was a waste and horrible place. This is describing the abyss. I saw that there were seven stars like great burning mountains. And to me, when I inquired regarding them, the angel said, this place is the end of heaven and earth. This has become a prison for the stars and the host of heaven. Now, the stars are very important. I did a presentation on the stars last year. I'm not going to run you through that at all. It's its own story, but all this is very tied up in stellar lore, okay? Now, the interesting thing is that I believe that Enoch is a visionary text in the same way that the Mithraic texts or the Mithraic liturgy is a visionary text. If you read the Mithraic liturgy, it reads like an alien abduction narrative. I'm like literally brought up into a flying disc that flies across the skies and so on. It's literally that literal. but this is from Hypostasis of the Archons. His thoughts became blind, and and having expelled his power, that is the blasphemy he had spoken. This is about Ialdabaoth. He pursued it down to chaos and the abyss. His mother, at the instigation of Pista Sophia, and this was covered very brilliantly this morning, and really major kudos to April. And she established each of his offspring in conformity with his power after the pattern of the realms that are above, for by starting from the invisible world, the visible world was invented. As incorruptibility looked down upon the region of the waters, her image appeared in the waters, and the authorities of the darkness became enamored of her, which is very oddly similar to the sons of God being enamored of the daughters of men. This, of course, is cosmic. But I do believe that these texts were arisen from psychedelic, for lack of a better term, psychedelic visionary experience. I don't think this is an unusual phenomenon throughout history. Now, these are the names of the Watchers. There are 12, okay? Sometimes there are 13, but that's not really a Watcher. It's sort of their prison guard. But as you see here, I mean, I'm not going to read all of these, but we see here that the Arachiel taught the signs of the earth, which geology, I suppose. Amoros taught enchantments. Azazel taught how to make knives, swords, shields, ornaments, and cosmetics. Gadriel also taught cosmetics and also taught weapons and killing blows. One thing that you'll notice, and one thing that I've talked about, is that if you look at ancient or medieval, Renaissance, maybe in a lot of Byzantine depictions of the angels, they're all basically trans. I mean, they're all dressed as women. They look like women. You know, they're all very tall and so on. But we see this with the Watchers, that there is a heavy influence of androgyny in cross-dressing for reasons still unclear to me. But we see one taught meteorology, taught the art of writing, courses of the moon, so on and so forth. They came and they taught all these arts, okay? Now, I believe that this particular story is not literal, that this is an allegory. But I think this is an allegory of a process that has repeated itself throughout history, that beings somehow have contacted us and given us arcane knowledge, okay? Now, this is from the Apocryphon of John, and we also have 12 authorities or 12 archons. I know that April discussed that there were seven. I mean, this is the whole thing with Gnosticism. It's, you know, there isn't no set canon, so to speak, with a lot of these ideas. But we see here that the it's very similar in some ways, that the archons are not only rulers, but they are sort of guardians or shepherds, let's say, of humanity. The bestowing of technology is not as explicit in the Gnostic text, but I believe it is implied. The 12 authorities then create the seven powers who represent the 7 days of the week. This is, again, Gnosticism here. Athoth, or help me out here, April. Athoth, goodness. I'm not even going to. Goodness, forethought, divinity, lordship, kingdom, jealousy, understanding. Yes, yes. They're just what are Greek words or maybe some invented language. I'm not exactly sure. But anyhow, so we see these same patterns emerge. Okay, now this is more recent scholarship as to the specific origin of the watches. And this derives from the Babylonian captivity. So this, some Israeli archaeologists have done some work on this and have posited that the origin of the watches derives from the Mesopotamian mythology of the antediluvian sages, the Apkallus, okay? The mythology of the watches derived from inverted versions of various Mesopotamian myths about Apkallus. Now, these are the same kind of figures. They're civilizing figures. They teach arts. They teach knowledge and so on and so forth. The sages were already regarded as dangerous and particularly malicious creatures upon which the Jewish authors could build their counter narrative. Okay, so this is, you know, the war of the gods, so to speak, the war of the tribes, the war of the religions. You know, your gods aren't gods, they're demons and so on. Among other associations, the Apkallus had strong ties to Mesopotamian demonology, and they were occasionally counted as evil beings capable of witchcraft. There's that seed pack again, the little purse. We saw that before in the Gnostic amulet, didn't we? So very interesting. And then, of course, the pine cone, which some people have connected to the pineal gland, okay? So this is a typical Apkallu. You know, different versions of them. Again, this is a mythology that has survived over thousands of years, which is always amazing to me that Sumerian mythology, I mean, starts in prehistory, basically, and was followed through this musical chairs wave of invasions going through Mesopotamia. You know, the Amorites would come, or the Syrians would come, whomever, the Akkadians, right? I mean, there would be this constant churning of empires, but they would all adhere essentially to the basics of Sumerian religion, but also maintain the Sumerian language as their sacred language, which is very, very interesting to me. Now, we just talked about the seven principles in Gnosticism. Well, there are seven Apkallu, okay? So he who finished the plans for heaven and earth, he was endowed with comprehensive intelligence, was allotted a good fate, born in a house, blah, 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 blah. I mean, you can just see it. I mean, what I'm trying to say is that we have these repeating numbers of 12 and 7. So I believe very much that the Gnostic authors were very much familiar with Enoch, very much familiar with the Apkallu, and were using that as the basis for the creation of the archonic stories. Now, personally, I don't believe that there are 12 or the 7. I think this is all interpretation. But I believe that they are devising allegories to describe a very real phenomenon. Okay. So this this is from Enoch again, First Enoch, talking about the women conceiving brought forth giants whose stature was each 300 cubits. Unlikely. These devoured all of which the labor of men produced until it became impossible to feed them when they turned to themselves against men in order to devour them and began to injure birds, beasts, reptiles, and fishes to eat their flesh one after the other to drink their blood. Then the earth reproved their unrighteousness. So we see the watchers come in, and it's like, wow, these guys are great. They're teaching us how to write and astrology and cosmetics and weaponry and all these kind of things. But there's a flip side. There's always a flip side in the exact same way that when colonists descend on a country to be conquered, they'll also bestow these technological gifts, don't they? But they use them as a tool of conquest. So why did the archangels have to dispense with the watchers? So this is from Enoch 9. Then Michael and Gabriel, Raphael, Suriel, and Uriel looked down from heaven and saw the quantity of blood which was being shed on earth and all the iniquity which was done upon it, and said one to another, it is the voice of their cries. The earth deprived of their children has cried even to the gate of heaven. So what we're seeing is that the gifts of the watchers brought war, essentially. And if this is based on the Akalu, I guess at the time of the writing, this would have been the Neo-Assyrian Empire. And if you know anything about history, the Neo-Assyrians were brutal. I mean, they loved being brutal. I mean, they would brag about being brutal in their friezes and all their stelas and all this kind of stuff. They were a very violent people. So I think that the Jewish apocalyptic authors who were writing First Enoch saw this activity and associated with, oh, it's like, look at these, you know, the walls of Babylon, look at this magnificent city. They must have gotten this knowledge from higher beings. But the flip side of it is just the incredible carnage that the Neo-Assyrian Empire had unleashed upon the world. So we're going to fast forward a couple thousand years now. This is the reappearance of the Watchers. 1773, First Enoch was rediscovered by a Scottish Freemason named James Bruce. Then this is just listing the various translations. The first translation was seen to be very poor, very inaccurate. It was sent back for a revision and then was sent back for another major translation and then a revision of the major translation. But while searching for the source of the Nile River, explorer James Bruce acquired three complete copies of the Book of Enoch in the Ethiopic language Ge'ez. These were brought with him back to Europe. I think it would be 50 years before the first translation of Enoch into the English language would appear in 1821. Okay. So this wasn't an accident. Bruce went specifically looking for it because he saw Enoch as a Masonic text, because of the association with Enoch, with Metatron and so on. I mean, it's a long story, but they specifically went looking for Enoch. This wasn't like he just happened upon it while he was exploring the Nile. All right, so agents of deconstruction, and this is gonna another time jump here. But it's all part of a continuum, because I believe that these entities that we're referring to, that we've devised these stories of, these visionary psychedelic stories of, they don't have our, you know, sense of mortality or sense of time. Their whole concept of history is much different than ours. Yes, this is one of my favorites. This is Augustine, St. Augustine, City of God, but he's actually quoting a pagan author who was on trial for witchcraft at the time. Now, this is interesting because a lot of people will quote this from the City of God, but will sort of overlook the fact that this comes from Apuleius, who wrote Metamorphosis, aka The Golden Ass, which is a fantastic story if you want to read a great comic novel from the Roman era. But anyway, Apuleius said that demons are agitated with the same perturbations of mind as men. They are provoked by injuries, propitiated by services and by gifts, rejoice in honors, and are delighted with a variety of sacred rites, and are annoyed if any of them be neglected. And this is where this whole OCD ritual kind of thing that I've been tracking, these mass rituals, I believe this is the origin of it. On them, on the demons of the air, as Apuleius is describing them, depend the divinations of augurs, soothsayers, and prophets, and the revelations of dreams, and from them also the miracles of the magicians. Okay, so you got to understand that the time this book is written, most of what was being passed off as magic was tricks. It was, stage magic. Exactly, it was a kind of technology. I mean, the great version. The great example of this is Glycon, the snake god, which is just a puppet with like a tube and somebody be underneath the temple talking into the tube and so on. So magic and science and technology were seen as one. So I had originally stumbled onto this whole explanation when I did a series back in 2016 called Lucifer's Technologies, where I looked at the Roswell, the quote-unquote Roswell crash. And as I was picking apart, realized that it was all ritualistic. It was very highly ritualistic. We won't go into that now, but that's worth its own presentation, okay? Now, this gentleman here, Victor Goddard, a very high-ranking military officer, fought in the South Pacific in World War II. He said something very similar to what Apuleius said. He said, the astral world of illusion is greatly inhabited by illusion-prone spirits, is well known for its multifarious imaginative activities and exhortations. Others pronounce upon mortality, spirituality, deity, etc. And this is the old joke that you'll see where, it's become sort of a meme where, somebody will contact machine elves or aliens or something, and they'll say like, your religions are all fake, you need a one world religion, bow to us, let us be inhabit you, and so on. But it's funny that, I mean, this guy is talking about this 70-80 years ago. All of these astral exponents who invoke human consciousness may be sincere, but many of their theses may be framed to propagate some special phantasm, perhaps of an earlier incarnation, or to indulge an inveterate and continuing technological urge towards materialistic progress, or simply to astonish and disturb the gullible for the devil of it. One thing that I've noticed, and this is what ties into Lucifer's Technologies, is that a lot of advanced technology breakthroughs seem to just come out of nowhere. And people like Tesla, for instance, will say that he was receiving transmissions from Mars, and this is where he got these ideas for all these amazing discoveries or creations of his. This is not unusual, and if anybody's a musician and has experience playing music, you know all about spiritual channeling. You know all about spiritual possession. It's common as dirt when you start playing. I've had experiences when I used to play where I would look at my hands and like I didn't even recognize what I was doing. I'd listen back to the tape and it's like, what? That's not something that I would play. It's an experience where something else is inhabiting you, something outside of you. Wing Commander Sir Peter Horsley, Equerry, which is the military advisor. Equerry means the military advisor to Queen Elizabeth. Suppose we are living in a multidimensional time track with a young primeval world, our own, and a much older world with advanced technology, all aging and developing side by side, conscious and sometimes stirred by the presence of the others, strange ships in the sky, images of ancient creatures, the impudent antics of poltergeists. So what he's saying is similar to what, these other quotes that we're talking about, that we are living somehow parallel dimensionally, transdimensionally. He used the metaphor of a record player that sometimes it skips its groove and, everything will go crazy and then it will return. So this is like, UFO flaps and so on. And, you know, I had an extended UFO sighting that I took photographs of and everything. And first of all, it was extremely unsettling. But second of all, when I looked at this object, it was a classic chevron that seemed to have like these giant lights on the bottom. I was like, how is that thing aerodynamic? How is that thing staying up in the air? Well, probably if it isn't some secret plasma technology that's being developed in a military base, it could be one of these phantoms or phantasms that Peter Horsley was talking about. Now, this is a book that had a tremendous, tremendous influence on me. John Keel, the author of the Mothman Prophecies, wrote a book called Operation Trojan Horse that came out the same year as another sort of formative book in the same genre called Passport to Magonia by Jacques Vallée. Okay. Keel is kind of like the extremely paranoid counterpart to Vallée. I mean, this guy, his paranoia knows no bounds. But he said, this is back in 69, he said, I abandoned the extraterrestrial hypothesis in 1967 when my own field investigations disclosed an astonishing overlap between psychic phenomena and UFOs. The objects and apparitions do not necessarily originate on another planet and may not even exist as permanent constructions of matter. Okay, the UFO manifestations seem to be, by and large, merely minor variations of demonological phenomena. Okay, so this is not a evangelical Christian or whatever. This is not a religious guy. This is a secular researcher, UFO researcher. And let's be clear that the term demonological demon, I mean, we're talking about the demons of the air. We're not talking about medieval demons with cloven hooves and so on. It's an entirely different phenomena, okay? Now, this is the text that really changed my way of thinking. It sort of put in the last piece. I'd been working on this Lucifer's Technologies series for a number of years, and that's a pun on Lucent Technologies. My wife worked at Lucent Technologies when they first opened, and she worked at the plant or the building in Murray Hill, New Jersey, where the transistor was first, quote unquote, invented. Okay, she worked in that same building, and it's a long story, but they're now owned by Nokia, so it's I don't even know what they're doing anymore. But anyhow, I was puzzling, what is the point of this? I understood this whole idea that goes back in history. We talked about Apuleius, the miracles and magicians and so on. If we're being given this technology, what is the point of it? Like, why? What purpose does it serve? What good would it do these beings that can't even exist in our realm? Okay. Well, let's get into it. This is Professor Carl Raske of the University of Denver. He wrote a paper in the early 90s called UFOs, Ultraterrestrial Agents of Cultural Deconstruction. Raske suggested that the search for meaning behind the UFO enigma was caught up in ideas about aliens from other planets in structured craft. Okay, and that's the ETI, the extraterrestrial hypothesis, ETH. Raske proposed that whatever was behind the UFOs was acting as a catalyst for change in ideas about what was possible and even acceptable. Okay, so this is 30 plus years ago. Think about all the changes in the past 30 years, okay? So he's talking about all these UFO flaps and these these ghosts in the sky, these ghost ships. And this goes back as, Miguel mentioned, this goes back to the Mandeans and the Yazidi, and arguably the Gospel of Judas. I mean, this is a very ancient idea or a very ancient observation even of contacting or being in contact or observing basically these glowing objects in the sky, these autoluminous objects that seem to come and go and seem to be peopled by, very short creatures, right? Very short beings. So just think about say, the UFO wave, you know, in post Whitley Strieber's communion. I was doing a show. I was talking to Mike Cleland, who some of you might know, and we were talking about communion. And I remember I was working in New York City in 1987 when that book came out. You could not walk by a bookstore. This is when there was a bookstore like every few blocks in New York, right? You could not walk by a bookstore without seeing that face, that alien face. You know what I'm saying? And that, so, you know, X-Files sort of arose from that whole situation. But there was a whole thing with intruders, all these, you know, the UFO wave. There were UFO conventions on a regular basis back at that time, early 90s. So the UFO, and this is like Bob Lazar. I mean, some of the things that we're seeing being discussed now that like people like me who, you know, are a little bit long in the tooth when it comes to ufology, you're like, oh, you're talking about that again? I mean, really, Bob Lazar? Come on, you know, wake up. But the point, the ultimate point, as Raschke sees it, is to change the culture by deconstructing it. And we'll get into what he means by deconstruction in just a moment. What this may mean, what this may indicate, is that UFOs may exist as a mega experiment in deconstructing our ideas of what is possible, our place in the universe, our ways of accepting what is real, and even our methods of cataloging sensory input. So just think, this book, this again, this is written 1991, I believe. Just think of all the incredible changes, the internet, cell phones, but also social changes, and just the basically, I would call it the collapse of morale among young people. The morale has been shattered. And this is something that he talks about as well. So there's Professor Raschke. He says, I substitute the prefix ultra, where one would expect extra, to stress that the phenomena in question may not only be from beyond the Earth, but from outside the matrix of space, time, and matter. And boy, we heard about that this morning, didn't we, right? You know, these beyond space, the Gnostic gods who are not even of this universe, right? Many theoretical physicists today have accepted that everything that falls within the range of empirical science may only be a thin strand of intelligibility interwoven with hidden folds of reality. Again, you know, we've been hearing about the Mandela effect. Sarah talked about the Mandela effect. You know, we've heard about, you know, Philip K. Dick and his shifting timelines, simulation theory. I mean, all these kind of things that were the fringe of the fringe of the fringe. You know, the richest man in the world is talking about on Twitter every day, right? Now, this is where Professor Raschke talks about deconstruction. Deconstruction is contrasted with destruction, the latter being an unconstrained act of demolition, while the former suggests an aim-governed and formative sequence of changes. Deconstruction is not sudden, but slow and inexorable. It is akin to a sculptor chipping away at stone to craft a figure. So far as UFOs are concerned, the deconstruction works upon human culture as a whole, although it may also have devastating effects on individual lives. So what Raschke believes and what he wrote about is that the UFO phenomenon was having a deconstructive effect merely by its existence, merely by the fact that people were witnessing these ships. You know, the psychological effect that it would have to see a technology, and this is something I can speak to from personal experience, where you are standing there on your front porch, staring at this giant chevron, wondering how the hell it stays up in the air, and realizing this beats me. I don't know. I don't know what that is. I don't know where it comes from. I don't know why it's just sitting there. Why is it choosing to sit there over my house? And I'll tell you another interesting story. When I had that sighting, I just watched a film called The Curse of the Man Who Sees UFOs about a guy who down in Monterey, California, who films them all the time. It's a very interesting documentary. You should check it out. So deconstruction is not destruction. It's a slow and deliberate dismantling to be replaced with a new form. UFOs serve as facilitators of cultural deconstruction, a process whereby long-standing structures of thought and action are dismantled so that new, more fluid, we hear about fluidity all the time, right? Modes of reflection can take hold. So again, 30 years ago, very much describing what we've seen in the past 30 years. We just haven't recognized it as such, right? I'm not saying that UFOs are the only aspect of this, but certainly technology is. And if you read Lucifer's Technology series on my blog, you know where my theory is about where all this stuff that we use every day comes from. The goal of deconstruction is not a cognitive or behavioral finality. It is motivated by a curiosity that can never be brought to closure. UFOs do not serve as ciphers to the code of the cosmos. They are, in a way, the code itself. This guy's an evangelical Christian. This is one of the most Gnostic things I've ever read in my life. You know what I'm saying? And this is pure Gnosticism right here. And actually, this entire paper is incredibly Gnostic, which is extremely interesting to me, given his background. But I mean, this right here, I mean, what do you think, April? Do you agree with me? Back me up here. Absolutely. Now, this is the money quote. This is the money quote. And this is some DMT art that we see a lot of. Thus, UFO visitations or intrusions may be traced back to some hyperdimensional point of origin. Furthermore, the visitors, rather than symmetrically or systematically studying, symmetrically is good too, our ways out of magisterial curiosity, maybe working with methodical dispatch to make us transparently conscious of, if not to elevate us towards, the realm in which they move and have their being. Now, this is what I'm saying. I was like, had this whole thing worked out, basically a book-length blog series on Lucifer's Technology. I was like, but why? What is this? Well, they want to move us up into their world. They want to bring us into their world. Maybe they're not exactly able to come into ours, but they want to bring us into theirs through these technological interfaces. And what this, another thing that kind of blew my mind when I read this is that I remember I read Andrea Poharich's book on Uri Geller, quote unquote. It's not really a book on Uri Geller. It's a book on this, basically these archons called the Council of Nine. And Poharich had claimed that the Council of Nine, aka the Archons, could only interface with us by computerizing our minds. Neuralink, right? Richest man in the world, what's he talking about? Computerizing our minds. I don't think it's possible, mind you. I don't think it's technologically possible. But there is certainly the desire to do so. So this technological interface, arguably given to us by these archonic forces in order somehow to break down our own system and bring us into their system. And this is the archons, okay? It's maybe a lot different context than the ancient Gnostic texts, but in my view, in my thinking, it's the same exact process, okay? It's the same exact process. Ah, yes, St. Terence. Now, you might be familiar that DMT is getting a very, very big push. DMT trials, DMT clinics. I am extraordinarily apprehensive about this. I was just reading an article yesterday. They have this new variant of DMT where they can extend your trip. I mean, it's usually like 20 minutes or half an hour, and they can extend it to an hour or more. I am alarmed by this. Now, I am not anti-psychedelic in any way, shape, or form. I partake myself, let's just say, but I am very alarmed by the indiscriminate use of psychedelics by anyone, right? And also, I am extremely alarmed when the government gets involved in it, because we have a long track record of the government abusing these compounds. Anyhow, Terence McKenna said, the feeling of doing DMT is though one had been struck by noetic lightning. The ordinary world is almost instantaneously replaced, not only with a hallucination, but a hallucination whose alien character is its utter alienness. another dimension, another world. You hear this all the time in the DMT literature. Nothing in this world can prepare one for the impressions that fill your mind when you enter the DMT sensorium. And that is what I am afraid of, okay? Now, the interesting thing about McKenna, and I haven't been able to find the quote, but I remember reading this some 30 years ago, where he said, you can only have a very small population or small percentage of the population involved in heavy psychedelics, heavy hallucinogens. If you go over that number, you start to destabilize. And I believe that that is the goal, the specific goal of these programs is to destabilize, okay? And now here's Dr. Rick Straussman. Dr. Straussman also suggested DMT may actually allow our consciousness to become a gateway into other planes of existence. He has numbers of field reports, testimonies, reports from his DMT experiences. I believe he was down in Arizona. He did this. Now he's getting involved in it again, which is a little concerning to me because I remember he said that he was stopping it because the reports were so consistent and so unsettling that he came to believe that some other force, objective reality force, was in contact with people, with human beings through these drugs, okay? Other test subjects that have used DMT in a lab setting have also suggested this may be happening based on their own experiences. While each person has their own unique experience on DMT, there are many similarities that are recurring in each person's experience. They each encounter a realm which is completely different than the one we're in right now, and they encounter other intelligent beings. Now, I always say that if one person sees a flying monkey or something, it's a hallucination. If two people see it simultaneously, it's something else. And if one person is reporting that they're going to some other realms and meeting machine elves or jesters, however they're described, okay, well, that's, you know, cultural accumulation, hallucination, so on and so forth. When, I don't know, 30 or 40 people involved in a laboratory test report the same thing, we need to start paying attention to this. You know, this is no game, okay? Now, the Watchers, the Watcher cult. One thing that I came to realize almost by accident is that there are Watcher cults, and there is a Watcher cult. We see these eyes everywhere. We see this one eye signaling. I mean, I believe that's related to the star of Algol, aka Ra's al Ghul, the demon's head. But we see this is at Chambers Street Station, which is two blocks away from 9/11. 9/11 from the World Trade Center. And this is the same installation. You know, I mean, I've seen this. I used to see this all the time when I was working downtown. You know, you come up and you see these eyes everywhere, and it's just like, well, what's this about? You know, and it's a long story that we don't have time to get into, but I believe this is very much about the watchers, the eyes, the watching. And then we saw this strange ritual where a bunch of randos just sort of created an eye formation around this little bit of shrapnel or whatever it is here. And of course, there's the CBS eye right there. Oh, again. So this, in my estimation, again, don't have time to walk you through it, but I believe that this is a depiction of the fallen angels coming up from the underground, coming up from Tartarus, this kind of formation here. This is called Oculus, which means eye. Just as that installation we saw at Chambers Street was called Oculus. Does this look like an eye to you? Like, why is it, you know, what the hell? It's a whole story. It's a whole thing. It kind of ties into the presentation I gave last year. I touched on some of this, but again, we don't have time to get into it. I know everybody's probably hungry, but it's called Oculus. Very clearly to me, winged shapes emerging from the underground. And this is the interior of Oculus here, right? And I was, gosh, World Trade Center Station, I was there all the time. I mean, one thing that I've said when I talk about this, like, I was supposed to be there that day. I was supposed to be going through World Trade Center that Tuesday. I don't know why. It was like I had the day off or something. But I was in that area so often that I can still feel the coolness radiating from the concrete in that subway station. So that was a very profound experience for me personally. And this is a rear view of Oculus. Again, what? Oculus? But it's being aimed at One World Trade Center, which I'm going to show you in just a moment, encodes Cepheus, Cepheus being the garden, Sorry, my Boston's coming through here. It's the garden, the Boston garden. I'm going to see the Bruins. So we see here, this is Cepheus, which is, you see everywhere you go because it's the model for church steeples. And we see it encoded here into the One World Order trade something tower. I don't know. I can never get that name right. But we see here, again, this is something, it takes a lot of walking through, but, you know, this is Cepheus here, Pegasus here, and Cygnus here. Now, what's the connection with Cygnus and the Watchers? Well, Cygnus is where the, in my interpretation, Cygnus represents one of the seraphim that blocked the way to the Garden of Eden. And, the, you know, it talks about the sword hilt that, that shines and flashes. I believe that's Deneb, which is the brightest star in that constellation. This is, again, I'd love to, you know, if I had an hour more, I'd love to go through this, but I don't. Yeah. So the Millennium Dome show. The Millennium Dome. Isn't that a lovely little edifice? Just fill you with the warm and fuzzies. And of course, I've got my pointer here. Don't forget the little obelisk here, the illuminated obelisk. One of my earliest posts on the Secret Sun with illuminated obelisks all around the world. And then we have one here. This is, you know, the sacred phallus, and this is the sacred womb here. Millennium Dome Show, 1999 to 2000. 999 performances. If anybody here has been to England, you know that 999 is the equivalent of 911, right? That's the emergency number, 999. And this is from the comic book that they gave out at the Millennium Dome Show. Oh, look, it's the Demon of the Air. What an amazing coincidence. Look at that little guy there. And oh, it's a daughter of man. Oh my goodness. Oh, wow. This is what the British government decided to do to celebrate, to bring in the new millennium, was this whole show. And, you know, it's based on The Marriage of Heaven and Hell by Blake. You know, we're talking about Blake again. And here's the little demon of the air. He's got his little bib on. I guess he was maybe having his little pudding or something. And daughter of man. I mean, look at this. Isn't that so, the coziest little thing you've ever seen? This is all about the Nephilim. And they mate, and the Nephilim flies off in a flying saucer. So what was the British? This is the British. This is Tony Blair, right? It's just like, why? What does this have to do with anything? Well, it has to do with the religion of the royal family. Because here's inside. Oh, the womb room. What's being born in the womb? Giants. There were giants on the earth in these days. Nephilim, look at the eye in the center there, too. The watcher and the progeny, right? And then, of course, you know, since it's the royal family, you've got to have the naked, afraid boy, right? You know, you're going to have that imagery because, you know, that's part of their religion as well, right? So the giants, these formless giants being born in the womb room. And, of course, also in the womb room, we have another, maybe a little bit more developed Nephilim, okay? So it's literally just Genesis 6-4. That was the British government's way of celebrating Y2K. 2010, Madison Square, Watchers, Event Horizon. They had these, you can't really see it here, but wait a sec. All right, so these are broken wings. These are all figures that have, you can't really see it. I'm sorry, this image here. But if you go online, you can see it. It's basically angels, fallen angels with their wings broken off in the back there. And, the, you know, these naked men just standing around Madison Square, which has been in the news lately, hasn't it? Let's see what's going on in Madison Square. Yes, witness, watchers, more watcher adoration. The ram's horns, again, this is supposed to be Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Come on, people. So this is the same neighborhood. I guess this is like the Watchers. Maybe this is where when they finally touch down, this is where we're going to land. So they took down, you know, they have all these friezes and all these figures representing justice and so on and so forth. And then they put up this lovely little creature with the ram's horns and the spaghetti arms and so on. And just the most sickening looking thing you've ever seen in your life. And New Yorkers, not known for their, fundamentalist panic, let's just say, are saying this thing is satanic, this thing is a disgrace, it's a disgrace to Ruth Bader Ginsburg's memory. Don't have time to go into it, but there is some rather sketchy background on this. I'll put it out on the blog. And yes, this is called Whiteout, same neighborhood. This is actually an artist depiction, but this is also Madison Square, these orbs. If you're familiar with a lot of this literature dealing with all these kind of extraterrestrial, ultra-terrestrial things, orbs show up all the time. I've actually seen orbs as well. They did not fill me with gladness and joy, let's just say. I'll just tell a story. Listeners and readers of mine know the story. My wife and my daughter and I were driving up Route 93, right? Going into New Hampshire. And as soon as we cross the border, we see this plane taking off from Manchester. And there are these two orange orbs that are circling around it. And when I looked, I was like, they look like they're trying to make that thing crash. It was very unsettling to see. And they look very sickly, too. Oh, orbs. Oh, here we go. All our friends, Donald J., right? King Solomon, Benny, and Emperor Jupiter. Oh, my goodness. What is this? You know, like, what is this? You know, like, I think this is Sisi from Egypt here, too. So this is Egypt. What's that?
Yeah.
So Sisi and King Solomon and Donald J., all adoring the orb. Yeah. These people think differently than the rest of us. To say the least. And look at Benny. He's having a great time. He's like, oh, this is awesome. And so we talked about the Apollo. This is Hollywood and Highland in Los Angeles. This is where the Oscars are held every year, as I like to call them, the Osors, the Osiris Awards, so to speak. There's the Apollo. What are they doing? And what are they doing there? You know, it's like, this is the Kodak, or formerly known as the Kodak Theater, I believe they changed name. You can barely see the Hollywood sign right through here. Oh, where's my pointer? There we go. Yeah, that's the Hollywood sign right there. So this is the gateway here. And we got up Kala. What? Like, what are they doing? Watchers. So it's interesting to me because you see all these different expressions of what I interpret as watcher worship. But they're very creative about all the different versions that they use. And it's like, what is this doing there? It doesn't make any sense. And of course, yes. So let me get to my my closing statement here. Okay. So interesting, the mushroom, magic mushroom, mushroom cloud, 1945, right? Same neighborhood as Roswell, wasn't it, right? And actually, the Roswell Army Air Force Wing was involved with Operation Crossroads in 1946, where they were setting off hydrogen bombs in Bikini Atoll and the Marshall Islands. So how many people know voodoo and so on? Like, what are the crossroads for? Like, who do you go to meet at the crossroads? And they're splitting the atom for Operation Cross. What are they telling us here? What's the message there? Right? And of course, Close Encounters, right? Very clear mushroom there as well. And actually, when you see the UFO and the tractor beam, usually there'll be like a cow getting lifted up into it. Just look at it and think, oh, that's a mushroom, okay? So all intimately connected, all intimately connected. And I believe, like I've said before, and like I said here, is that these psychedelics, magic mushrooms, and so on, being used civilians, let's just say, be given heroic doses of the compounds, how is that? That's never going to end well. I mean, we had, 40 years of MKUltra, doing the same thing. And that didn't end very well either. If it ended at all, if it didn't just change form, right? What I've tracked is the footprints of a new religion based on the Watchers and their gifts of technology, gifts that are used to cement elite control and turn the rest of us against each other while we fight for scraps from their feasts. The core of this new faith is mass ritual as both spellcraft and entrainment. So that's basically how I see all this, that this is mass ritual, very much like every civilization in history practiced. Okay, so people get their backs up when you say, well, these elites are practicing these mass rituals with this stuff. And they're like, oh, hey, man, what are you? Oh, tin foil, whatever, right? And it's like, name me a major civilization, society, kingdom, you name it, that didn't have mass ritual. Just name me one. It never existed, okay? This is just the way human beings behave, okay? So let me just make my closing statement here. In closing, allow me a bit of editorializing. I think the division between the esoteric and the exoteric has outlived its usefulness. I think a period of reconciliation is in order. A house divided upon itself cannot stand. We are all facing a deadly enemy, the enemy of indifference in the face of clear and present spiritual dangers, and spiritual as you know, as well as transdimensional, okay? Without the exoteric becomes hidebound and inert. Without the exoteric, the esoteric drifts off into endless ethers of supposition. The esoteric and exoteric both have their own great gifts, and a synthesis of the two implies that we could form a powerful coalition against what we've seen here today. We've all seen how this process played out in the arts, popular culture, and even politics. What I'm referring to is that all the bands that were completely obscure, totally left field, becoming over the years, becoming recognized, becoming mainstream. This might seem like a facile metaphor, but I think that the same process applies, because I think that the arts and the popular culture are inherently spiritual as well. I think they're just forms of the same impulse behind religion. We all fight not against flesh and blood, but endless digital distractions, turning our children into dopamine-addled zombies. I see the footprints of the archons in the fraying of the social contract, and fighting against it will require all hands on deck. So what I'm trying to say here is that, we all know that there's a lot of jostling and jockeying and finger pointing between the exoteric and the esoteric. But it reminds me of old Trotskyites and Stalinists arguing in a Paris cafe while the world just completely passes them by. You know what I'm saying? I mean, true spirituality, true religion is definitely a minority concern, certainly in the West. And what are the results of that? One of the results is that we're literally seeing a zombie apocalypse taking place on streets all across our country. Okay. This combination of fentanyl, which seems like it comes straight from hell. Okay. I actually was on fentanyl, so I have experience with it. But combined with this animal tranquilizer that is causing people's skin to fall off in strips, and they're all walking around like this, or they're bent over like this, and they're zombies. And what I keep saying is that zombies were real. Zombies were victims of drug-induced brain damage, okay? They used the toxins from the bladder of a pufferfish. So this is all real, okay? In closing, I see the archons as being real. They might not be physical beings as we understand them, but I believe that they have been acting upon our world for a very long time, and the timetable seems to be speeding up. And like I said, I believe that this is an all hands on deck situation. And if you want to start finding people to reach out to and have conversations with, maybe people and people involved in more traditional religions, maybe more open-minded people that you can find, this might be a good way to break the ice. We are in trouble. We're in very serious trouble. It brings me no joy to say that, but civilization is collapsing at these fringes, and it's going to spread into the center, okay? We have entire populations that have been written off, all right? We have entire cities that have been written off, entire industries that have been written off. And these people don't just go away. They're succumbing to a horrific collapse that is being accelerated by drugs and technology, okay? This is very real. Like I said, we have a real zombie apocalypse going on right now. We are in danger, and we all need to band together, because we have, I think I've, you know, in this very short presentation here, just giving you an idea of who I think the real enemy is. And they are classic colonists, classic imperialists, okay? And they behave exactly the way that human colonists and imperialists have acted throughout history. You know, call them the Watchers, call them the Djinn, call them the DMT, machine elves, whatever. But it's all the same thing, in my estimation, and it's something that we need to start waking up to. And I mean, I'm an optimist. I think that we're going to win, but I want to win with a minimum of casualties. Okay, and that's all I have to say.
I guess we should do a couple of questions. Are aliens real, Ellie?
I don't know.
There you go. She's not convinced. She's not convinced. All right.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Chris, I have two questions. When, I don't know if this is working. I hope the online
it is. I can hear
it. It is. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. When these images appear above ground, the bas reliefs, the statuary, the all-seeing eye, the images that you were showing in the subway station and such, do you feel that these things appear with intention, or are they kind of a leakage of what might be called some collective or shared subconscious into the above ground culture? Is there intention behind it, or is it a leakage of some sort?
Well, in the public setting, it's definitely intentional, because if you're familiar with the whole process that they have to go through, where everybody and their grandmother has to sign off on these things, and you know these things are all scrutinized by all these various people, by lawyers and so on, there's no way that it can be unintentional. I think there are definitely unintentional emanations or expressions of this. The thing that I've come to believe is that this cult, as I see them, are so dangerous because they believe that they're the good guys. You know, they're on the side of the angels. I didn't get into, there is a literature on this that I didn't have time to go into, but there is a corpus of literature where it's explained that they were the good guys, that they fell, you know, for us, they fell on our behalf. This was all for our benefit. And it's all just this cosmic misunderstanding that the good guys were locked up while the bad guys go free, like Michael and again, I believe this is all allegory. I don't believe there's actually a figure called Michael that has a sword and stabs a dragon. It's all just a way of expressing the ineffable. But I can't see for the life of me how these mass scale emanations of this. And again, they think they're the good guys.
And one follow-up, and then I'll release the mic. It seems to me that occultism in general is a revivalist movement of pre-Christian religious forms. So if we go back to Persian expressions, Egyptian expressions, personally speaking, I find many of these archetypal images, whether it be the all-seeing eye or some of the Persian deities, deeply alluring. I probably have tattoos of some of them. And some of these things certainly do speak to aspects of the human psyche in a way that's very ineffable, very powerful, enormously appealing. Is there, as you see it, a dark and a light side? I mean, I'd like to know your thoughts on that.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. But this is what I'm saying. I mean, I believe this symbolism and everything is being weaponized, but it's being weaponized by people who think that they're the good guys. You know, there's a great old Grant Morrison Superman comic where Lex Luthor, he's the hero. Right. He's the hero of the story because Superman's this alien. Like, who the hell is he just barging in and smashing everything up? You know, Lex Luthor is the cold, rational human voice that's going to save humanity from this alien invasion. And that was like, and Jack Kirby talked about how, you know, Dr. Doom saw himself as the good guy. Like he was, and, you know, my pop culture obsessions here. William B. Davis, who played the Smoking Man in X-Files, he said, I was the hero of that series. I was a good guy. Mulder was just this loose cannon just running around waving his pistol and, you know, making a mess of everything. I was the cold rationalist. You know, I was trying to save what could be saved, you know, what was left of humanity. So that to me is the true danger, is not that, you know, they're like these cringy kind of like, oh, look at me, I'm bad. You know, I'm going to be bad. You know, it's like that never goes anywhere. The real danger is that people are like, look at me, I'm good. I know better than you. I'm going to save you or destroy you. Trying, you know, I know the way the world should be. Everyone should bow to my, you know, impulses and beliefs and so on. That to me is the real danger, is the weaponization of what they think is right. You know, and so when you react to a lot of the symbolism, yeah, objectively, it's not evil or whatever. It's just somebody's religion from the past, right? But this group that I'm talking about, and I hope to, I just gave you a little taste of how these things are appearing in the culture. And once you start seeing it, you can't unsee it. It's like, it's all being put out there by governments, corporations, you know, and what is driving it? I don't know. But I honestly believe that, like, you know, like Klaus Schwab and like Bill Gates, they think they're right. And they're trying to do the right, you know, because we're just stupid. We're just stupid peons. We don't know any better. You know what I'm saying? And that's, you know, that's how every horror throughout history has emerged. You know what I'm saying?
All right. Let's give you a nest today.
Hey, I'm just wondering if you've seen much anime or Evangelion?
Some.
Evangelion has a lot of the...
Oh, yeah. And also, what is it? What is it? The something of the Metatron? What is that one called? You know what I'm talking about? Uh-uh. I'm not very well versed in anime, but I know the Japanese just love taking whatever they can get and just throwing it into the pot, you know.
Well, the twelve authorities and the seven powers. When you're talking about that, and Evangelion is all about these kids who
is that Neon Genesis?
Yeah. And it's really, I think, more than a lot of the Western stuff. You really see how they're saying that these powers are out there in this larger than life story where the kids have to learn to operate the giant mech suits and they have to face the angels who have the same names as the Watchers.
See, but I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, I've always been a huge fan of Japanese culture when I was very young. I mean, a lot of this more recent stuff I'm not familiar with because it's not my generation. But, you know, Japan, they're in very deep trouble as a nation, just as a nation.
And
yeah, but, you know, and in South Korea, I mean, a lot of these like hyper urbanized Asian cultures that we rely on to keep the machines running and to make the machines and so on, you know, they're starting to collapse. And it's alarming to me. But, and this is why I think that, you know, technology is a mixed blessing. You know what I'm saying? And we need to be much more conscious of its shadow side because it will wipe us out. And like I said, I mean, the collapse has already started. I hate to say it, but it's true.
All right. Anything from the chat, Val?
Shay? Oh, from the chat?
from the internets. Grace O'Hara for Chris Knowles. Do the other planets and stars have inherent divinity? Are these planets and stars the Archons embodied, or are the Archons parasitic to those so-called heavenly bodies?
I'm going to pass that off to Mr. Connick here. Yeah. I think that is
that's a John Lamb Lash territory for sure, or David.
That's an April question.
We can shelve it till tomorrow and see how we do as a group.
I hate to say it, but I'm very much a nature mystic. So I think all expressions of nature and creation are inherently good. So even the dangerous ones, they play their part.
All right. One more, and then we better close it up again. We do have the panel tomorrow, so there will be time for everybody to get their questions in.
Hey, I just wanted two quick things. I've also noticed the eyes all over the place, the Watcher cult thing, but you've talked a lot about on the blog the song Teardrop, and it's a big kind of catalyst and lots of layers of sinker embedded in it. But I wonder if it's maybe a shot across the bow to the Watcher cult, as in a teardrop in the Watcher's eye kind of thing.
I doubt it, but you know, the composer of that song would be very much at home among us and in this building. Make of that as you will.
Yeah. And just the other thing too, about, I don't know too much about Sumerian like music or anything, but I thought it was interesting that they have the 12 and the seven, you know, the scales, the chromatic scale is 12 notes and the heptatonic scale is 7 notes.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so yeah, there must be some kind of overlap there.
Nature is music. Music is nature. You know, and Tolkien said that the world was sung into creation, you know, in his Rings mythology. So.
All right. Well,
one last question.
Do we have another? Hold on.
All right. Well, I mean, they can hear me anyway. So I just wanted to add to what the gentleman had just said. I actually know where you're going with that, and I think that it is the peacock teardrop is what you're referring to, right? Yeah. See, it's an inter-genre symbol. So anyway, that's all I have. Yes,
awesome. Well, thank you.
Melek Taos, right?
Melek Taos, yeah, the peacock angels. In alchemy, the peacock is that process right before complete destruction or after destruction.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Did you see my thing where I posited that the phoenix is Lyra?
Yeah. Elvis's favorite animal was the peacock. You knew I was going to say that.
Beautiful creatures. Beautiful, magnificent creatures.
All right. Well, also, please give a round for Chris. And, we will still have more. Thank you.